Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. It's always a joy when you come to the neighborhood and hang out for a little bit. I'm excited about our conversation today because we've got my buddy Tom Nichols. He's a retired, now retired professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. And Tom is one of these guys who just keeps it real. He brings it straight to the street level. And I'm looking forward to a great conversation. He's a leading specialist on international security affairs, especially Russia-U.S. relations, nuclear strategy, NATO issues. So we're going to get into that, but we're also going to have a little bit of fun on the political side, because Tom has kind of wiped the dust of the Republican Party from his feet. He's been trying to pull me out. I've been trying to pull him back in. We'll get into a little bit of that as well. Coming up on the Michael Steele Podcast right after this. Well, everybody, welcome again to the Michael Steele Podcast. This brother that we have on for this conversation today is someone that I have an immense amount of admiration for. I've known a long time, as you know, as I said, coming in, he's one of these guys in the national securities spectrum that, you know, you when he starts talking, the only thing you can do is sit at his knee and take out your notepad because you're about to learn something. But even more than that, you know, Tom and I dance in the political space. We're now working together in the democracy space. It is such a joy to have you on, man. Welcome.
It's great to be with you, Michael. Thanks so much for having me back.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when it's time to get smart, get smart again, you know, I was like, okay, let's call Tom because there's some stuff going on in the world. We just need to get some clarification on. So I think how I want to set up our conversation is in two parts. The first, more globally, where things are moving at I wouldn't say so much rapid, but a very interesting clip relative to what's happening between Russia and Ukraine, with the U.S. now stepping up, I guess, seemingly its involvement in sort of pushing or at least applying pressure with Secretary Blinken and the Defense Secretary going and meeting with Zelensky. What's your take, assessment of where we are in light of those recent activities?
Well, I think the most important thing to understand is that this is still a crisis. We haven't settled into some kind of routine here, which means that the Biden administration, to its credit, is improvising everything and improvising it really well. But this is basically, you know, everybody, and I mean everybody, including our European allies, they're all making it up as they go because there's a major war raging in Europe, which is the thing we've tried to prevent from happening since 1945. So where I think we are is we're still waiting to see how hard the Russians are going to push. I mean, I know that may sound strange, because I'm sure a lot of people thinking they're pushing as hard as they can. Bad news is they're not, and it could even be worse. And of course, we're still waiting to see if the Russians are going to rattle more chemical or nuclear sabers. And in the meantime, I think we've just gotten together with our allies after the initial shock of this nightmare has kind of worn off, that we are just going to flood the Ukrainians with weapons and assistance and money and training and bog the Russians down, because that's what the Russians have coming to them.
Tom, here's the frustration for a lot of folks like myself with not what you said because you said it, but because what you say is what should have been done long before we find ourselves where we are now in terms of putting the military hardware behind the Ukrainians so that they would have been in a stronger position to deal with this. I mean, there were conversations going back into the fall of last year about what was coming. I mean, there were smart folks like yourself saying, y'all know this could escalate fairly quickly into something we don't want to see on the European continent. And yet here we are with Zelensky and the Ukrainian leadership still, okay, this week is the exception, begging for further military hardware and engagement by their supposed European and American allies.
Well, let's a couple. First, I'm just going to take an I told you so here. I wasn't talking about this last week. You know, people are always happy to point out when I'm wrong, and I think I'm pretty good about owning it when I'm wrong.
Right, right.
When I fumbled a prediction, I was writing stuff in 2015, you know, 7 years ago, saying get more defensive weapons so that the Russians will know that they cannot win any kind of conventional blitzkrieg into Ukraine. Right, so right. I'm just going to stand back and say,
nope,
there were plenty of people warning you, and I was one of them a long time ago. On the other hand, I want to be fair, not only to the administration, but to the Europeans and to NATO. First of all, while Ukraine is a friend, they're not technically an ally. They are not in any legal or diplomatic sense. Right. An ally. So we didn't have the same alliance requirement to arm the Ukrainians. And this is going to sound really mean-spirited because Ukrainians are fighting for their lives, but it did take the Ukrainians a long time to get their act together. And I mean, going back to 2002, 2003, 2004.
Right. You don't think they took seriously the whole threat that Russia really presented to them?
They just weren't a very well-functioning government. And, you know, I think those first 10 years after 1992 were just a wasted decade. And, you know, to their credit, the Balts, for example, and you've seen some of this, you've seen some of this on social media, you know, where some of the Baltic leaders have pointed out, hey, well, you guys were all busy, you know, fighting with each other and waiting around in a lot of corruption and spitball fights in Kyiv. You know, the rest of us were kind of getting our house in order and getting up to speed to become NATO partners, to be, you know, to get that kind of assistance and money and weaponry. So, you know, let's not be super hard on the people that have held back, you know, 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. The other thing I think is that we were all in shock that we didn't gear up to get a lot of weapons to Ukraine because, and this is where now, you know, after patting myself on the back, I'm going to say I was one of the people who was wrong. We thought, oh man, this is a nightmare. It's going to be over in a week. Yeah, no one counted on the utter baffling, startling incompetence of the Russian military. And I feel bad. I'm feeling a little mean about that because I pride myself on being an expert on Russia. And even I didn't think that, you know, eight generals
they
killed.
Would fall that flat. Yeah, eight generals are dead. Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's pour one out a little bit here, you know, for all of the dashed expectations 6 weeks ago. With that said, I also think there's one other thing that I'm going to try and, you know, push back on here with you. And that is, I think the Biden administration started doing a lot that they didn't get credit for early on in terms of starting to get weapons going there, keeping the NATO together. You know, there was this big meeting at Ramstein yesterday, which was pretty cool, you know, 40 European nations getting together. Right. That doesn't just happen. When the Russians first did this, their expectation was that NATO would just crack and splinter and everybody would just back off and say, Ukrainians aren't my problem.
Right.
And so I think those first few weeks where the Biden administration kind of quietly and behind the scenes said, no, Ukraine is everybody's problem. NATO needs to speak with one voice on this. And they actually achieved that. I mean, NATO, I was talking with somebody earlier today and I said, you know, when God willing, when all this is over, if we're all still here, NATO ought to hang a picture of Vladimir Putin in its headquarters in Brussels, you know, as like our hero, you know, our new founder.
Right.
I mean, by the time this thing is over, NATO could end up being 32 countries, including Finland and Sweden.
So given that Putin seems to have saved NATO, right?
And Biden through his efforts.
I don't want to short sell the president's efforts here because I know exactly what it would have been like if Donald Trump were president right now.
I think we both know it would have been, the do not congratulate notes would be flying and Trump would have picked up the phone and said, congratulations on your new acquisition. I hope you can, I can build a hotel in Kyiv.
That's it. That's it. There's no doubt about it. And that 40 member NATO meeting that occurred would not have occurred. There would not have been the strengthening, but rather devaluing and further disintegrating the alliance. Because after all, he was the guy, the president who was planning to, if he had a second term, to leave NATO. So I think we all need to understand that and appreciate that regardless of anything else. And we can talk about when we get into the second part of our conversation around the politics of this, as well as what's happening here at home, how the Biden administration has not, I think, effectively sold this. I thought the State of the Union should have been only about democracy. Yeah. I mean, and you can weave little stories about your economic policy and infrastructure and all that other stuff into the broader theme, because without the democracy, folks, you don't get to do infrastructure. On that, I'm sorry.
I sort of miss the days when presidents had better comms shops, all of them.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
It just seems like, you know, even going back into the Obama administration and, Bush 43 before that, I mean, the days where you had one chief speechwriter who cracked the whip and put everybody on the same page seems to have ended somewhere in the 90s. And I miss it.
Well, Reagan was the last one that really kind of pulled all those pieces together. For example, when, you know, you had people saying, hey, you know, you can't say Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. It was like, okay, yeah, watch me. You know, it's just understanding the moment and being able to communicate in that moment to me is powerfully important, which then begs the question for me, the sort of ancillary question to the point you made about how Putin has saved NATO by creating this opportunity for a reimagination of the alliance. How can NATO save Putin?
At this point, we've tried so many times to talk about off-ramps. He doesn't want one.
Yeah.
I mean, you're dealing with somebody. That's the problem is, you know, that he really, I think, believes that he's on this holy mission. And I've written about this, this problem of, you know, this whole interlock between Putin and the Russian Orthodox Church that, you know, is, I've told people over and over again, I'm an Orthodox Christian. I find this, you know, grievous and sinful and horrible. Right. But the question now is, can you really make this such a slog that at some point, even his military commanders will come to him and say, there is no, you know, that there is no escalation that's going to help us here. Even a nuclear weapon isn't going to fix this.
Right.
And that what they, if, you know, if the Russians were competently led, and I don't mean, you know, morally.
Right. Right.
I mean, just if you really wanted to be an evil genius about this, you'd say, look, we took our shot. We screwed it up. You need to purge your military. You need to pull back, to keep the territory you're sitting on, call a timeout, and then take 3 or 4 years to purge your military and find out what went wrong here. And if you want to go at it again, you know, this is me talking to Putin as an advisor, right? If you want to go at it again, then you're going to have to, you know, come at it a different way with a better military down the line. And he just keeps doubling down, thinking, if I just get a bit, of course, this is very much the Russian way.
Right.
If I just get a bigger hammer.
Right. Exactly.
And I think that will put him in a very desperate situation. I think that the most important thing that's happened is that NATO has not directly intervened in this. And I think in a kind of strange way, that has driven a bunch of people in Russia completely crazy.
Because they expected they would be. And so
they'd almost prefer it because it would be less humiliating than losing to the Ukrainians.
Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think it goes to your earlier point about how NATO assessed Putin and Russia, and how Putin and Russia assessed NATO's response and the American response. And in some regard, Tom, I think you're kind of looking at this is that, you know, you've got these two vestiges of the Cold War kind of looking at this entanglement through a Cold War lens. The assessment of what we think their capabilities and their responses would be, how they're going to perform, what you thought they would do. It struck me, and I've been really wanting to ask you this question because it has struck me as a student of this period, of that period in the Cold War, and just fascinated by all of it and understanding the mindset behind someone like Putin. I would say that my taste on this is that these were two big ships that really kind of passed each other, didn't realize that they were doing it. I mean, it's one of these things that, you know, someone thought that, you know, you'd fire the missile first, or you would land troops first, or when you did, you, like you said earlier, you're going to just steamroll over this poor little nation of Ukraine. You know, they watched what Obama did with Crimea in 2014. The U.S. very much, again, a Cold War. That was a Cold War position. All right, you guys go ahead and take that, because we don't want to further damage, you know, the relationship or create any tensions, which is one of the things that was driving me nuts about this whole thing from the very beginning. How, oh, we want to avoid World War III. Baby, we've been involved in World War III since 2014, if not before.
Well, you know, a couple of things about that.
One is, shoot me down if I'm wrong. You're the war college guy.
So. If you're going to, you know, keep hitting Obama with a shoe, the only thing I would ask you is to give me the other shoe, show up so I can join in on foreign policy, because I wrote about this at the time. I could understand from a very in the kind of antiseptic intellectual way that Obama sometimes viewed foreign policy to say, okay, Crimea in particular, right? It's largely Russian, traditionally been a part of Russia. Khrushchev hands it to Ukraine as a quote unquote gift in 1954, which mm-hmm. pisses everybody off.
Mm-hmm.
After 91, the Ukrainians say, thank you for the gift, we're keeping it. You know, but again, the time to think about solving that was 30 years ago. And you can blame every American administration for not saying, okay, where are the flashpoints here? Where are the unresolved, screwed up borders? For folks who want to read about this, I wrote a piece for The Atlantic called Stalin's Revenge, about why Soviet borders are a complete hot mess mm-hmm. in every direction, because they were intended to be. They were created to be a problem. But by the time Crimea comes along, Obama has already taken a powder on Syria.
Yep.
He has talked about pivoting to Asia. And of course, if you pivot to, you're pivoting away. And the Russians heard that. I think the missed opportunity was not to confront Putin in Crimea, where that was just going to be out of our hands because of the nature of geography and local power. But in Syria, that we should have just flattened the Assad regime for using chemical weapons. And instead, we let Lavrov pull his, well, you know, we can help you with the chems and carry. And I mean, it was just utter incompetence from top to bottom. But what comes later, I think, is something different. You know, you were talking about the Cold War lens, about thinking about this. Even without the Cold War, if you just took a map and said, here's a country that's three times bigger than the country it's about to attack, has a much larger, much more experienced military, many 500 aircraft to 67 right. aircraft, and they are surrounding the target country on three sides and have three axes of advance into this country, and the country is led by Zelensky, a guy with no experience running a country, you know. There's a great line in the movie History of Violence, but I won't drop the F-bomb because we're a family podcast. But William Hurt is a mob boss, looks around at all these dead guys that have just gotten whacked by his opponent, and he says, how do you fuck that up? And I keep looking at this, and William, God rest his soul, and William Hurt's voice, looking at all these dead Russian generals going, how do you fuck that up?
Yeah.
So that, but Putin is very much looking at this through a Cold War lens. He really thought this was going to prove once and for all that the Slavic world belongs to Russia. NATO is a paper tiger. The Russian military is a fearsome force. I mean, this has reordered the world. It could be, and I'm going to go all Francis Fukuyama here. There's Fukuyama had a piece recently that kind of got pushed out of the way and all the doom scrolling. But Fukuyama said, look, if the Russians lose to Ukraine and not to NATO, this is a kind of transcendent moment that could open up all kinds of instability in Russia. The exposure, it turns out NATO is a tiger with very real claws, and the paper tiger is the Russian military. This is why we keep worrying about the nuclear scenario, by the way, because pretty much all they have left is the threat
of the nuclear option. But even before that, though, Tom, because you actually set up the next discussion point that is emerging right now, and that is, okay, I think the nuclear weapon option, just from my own limited understanding, is that's when Putin is locked himself in the bathroom, and the toilet is running and the sink is running, and you know he's hearing things, you know, and he's just ordering.
He's yelling, why does everybody think I'm fat?
Right. And so that scene is saved for a much, much later movie. But what we have seen him do just in the last 24 hours is to cut off the gas pipeline to Bulgaria. Bulgaria and Poland.
Yeah.
What does that mean in this scenario under your assessment? But then a wider gas purge by Putin, saying, okay, not just Poland and Bulgaria, but we're now going after all these other little nation states, given the fact that they're going to be a little less dependent on that gas because we're in the late spring going into summer. So I ain't got to heat my house until probably December. What's your assessment there?
Well, a couple of things. First, this is a very weird war because both combatants are making sure that energy resources are flowing through the combat area. It's really, you know, because it's in everyone's interest
to do that. To do that.
The real question is not, can Putin really put the screws? Again, talk about dumb military planning. If you're going to talk about cutting off gas, you invade in August. You don't invade in March. And I wonder, and I'm curious about this, because you were talking about the Putin locked in the bathroom scenario, or, you know, the Putin in the bunker scenario.
Right.
I wonder if he is unhealthy in some way and thinks he's running out of time to do this, because that was...
I've read that.
Doesn't look good. But I have nothing to go on because I am no longer a government employee, of course, and I don't have.
I think he's on immune suppressant medication right now, which is why he's got people at that table 7 miles away from him.
Well, he's got like that prednisone bloat or something that's going on.
Right.
But anyway, so can he wait that long? And the other question is, okay, so he can try and push around these smaller countries that are dependent on Russian gas. What if the Germans say, oh yeah, well, we're not going to buy any more of your gas. We're going to start restarting nuclear reactors. We're going to start, you know, using other sources. I mean, this is what the people have been pushing the Germans to do. You know, the problem with gas is that if you don't sell it somewhere, you can't eat it.
It doesn't make a good syrup.
No. You know, it's like when people talk about, well, what happens if we go to war with China and they cut us off or we cut them off? You know, we are handcuffed to them, but they are what's that line from Watchmen? I'm not locked in here with me. You're locked in here with me.
Right.
Right. Exactly. And that's how a lot of these relationships are. In the international,
and neither one of us can get out.
So Putin's like, well, I'm not going to sell gas and oil to anybody. Well, good luck with that. So I'm not I mean, again, it just the
well, why have the Saudis been such a pain in the ass then? Why are these mofos sit back telling Biden?
I'm sorry, as opposed to the time when they've always been a really helpful. I mean, I'm, you know, what are we remembering something? This golden age of Saudi civic involvement in the world.
I've never understood that relationship with the U.S. I know it goes all the way back to Daddy Bush at all, but I've never understood it. It makes no sense to me because that is not even a good the enemy of my enemy scenario. That's just been abusive.
I barely am keeping up with what's going on in Russia. Don't ask me to explain our relationship with Saudi Arabia. But, you know, again, I think some of this, though, is the distinct personality of the crown prince at work here.
Right.
And again, why would that guy feel emboldened after, I don't know, the last 4 years of the previous presidency? I mean, Joe Biden, I feel like I'm being overly, you know, because we're both conservatives or men of the right or former.
Right.
So me sitting here saying, you know, you got to be fair to Joe Biden does not come
naturally off the tongue.
But you know, Biden got dealt a really bad hand in every direction.
He did.
And so, you know, I mean, I don't know what you could do about the Saudis here. And Iran still exists. Yes. That problem is still out there.
Right. You still have Iran out there. And the Saudi piece for me relative to Russia and China and others is just how using a UN sort of backdrop, how some of these nations are either, you know, thumbing their nose directly or indirectly or quietly supporting the U.S. effort. And it just really speaks to the point you made a moment ago about just how much geopolitically this landscape is changing. If it's particularly more so if Ukraine winds up taking this thing all the way to the bank, and winning this war either outright or just even perceptually.
Let's define winning. Winning means Ukraine continues to exist.
As its sovereign self. Right.
Let's lower the expectations here.
Right. You know, well, we're not talking about military victories.
There's not going to be any march, you know, to Minsk or something.
The Arc de Triomphe, in Ukraine. No, there's none of that.
But for them to survive, and you know, I was one of the people who was really worried back in the day. You know, you guys just elected a comedian. I mean, he's an actor. You know, and I know, right?
Because we elected an actor Reagan, too.
I can hear the people out there listening going, "Well, you two Republicans elected an actor." Yes, after he had twice governed our largest state.
Yeah.
and yet the man proved equal to the moment. I mean,
he did.
Crisis reveals character.
So a couple more before we switch up and bring it home a little bit on the domestic side. What is your assessment? Because a lot of analysis out there that I've read in the last 12 or 13 hours now around this unexpected prisoner exchange, given where things are. And what I'm talking about here is the trading of the 30-year-old U.S. Marine veteran Trevor Reed, who was jailed in Moscow for trying to drive the KGB off the road or some made up crap. Yeah. And a Russian drug trafficker, Konstantin Yaroshenko, who is serving long time prisons term here in the U.S., but he's a drug kingpin. But yet they struck a deal. How did that happen in the midst of all of this?
It's really strange because I think this deal was in the works long before the war, and yet the war didn't derail it. And I'm trying to be optimistic here. Because I feel like we've been living through a six-week version of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It means there's still a channel open somewhere, mm-hmm. and that someone at the top said, this can happen. It makes the Russian government look good to say, We brought one of our boys home from, you know, these scummy American prisons. Of course, wait, if they decide that he's going to serve his time in Russia, he'll be praying.
He'll be, yeah, he'll be asking to come back.
Allenwood or wherever the hell he was. But, and, you know, it takes a kind of a thorn. I mean, if they really were going all in on, you know, this is the end of everything, they would have said, no, we don't, you know, we don't need any good press about this, and you can keep him, and we're going to keep your guy. So I took it as a good sign. I mean, I think there are a lot of people in the Kremlin who thought this war was a terrible idea and are probably as worried about where it could go as we are. The problem is that those people are not in the defense ministry or the president's office.
Right.
But the spooks, you know, and it's been interesting because the Russian intelligence services have really been taking it in the shorts on this. Which, you know, it's like, look, I suppose if you're worried about where all this could go and how bad the crisis could get, having a big division between the intelligence and the military guys is something you actually want. So I want to add one more thing about the Russia thing, because I want to give one more props to Biden about something. Sure. You know, all through this war, the Americans have used intelligence brilliantly.
Kudos on that. You're right. They have.
But there's an interesting thing. I saw yesterday people were giving the Biden administration a lot of static for not putting sanctions on Putin's mistress. And I actually think, for reasons that I'm not even going to say in public, I actually think there's a good reason not to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think this is, again, smart statecraft on the part of the president, who has weathered a six-week war in the middle of Europe without it spreading or escalating into a NATO-Russia war. And I think we have to, you know, just, I mean, I admit, though, I'm white-knuckling this one, because every day this goes on is a day where something unforeseen could happen.
Right. Well, that goes to something you said in describing this war. You referred to it as the forever war. What did you mean about that? Was that, you know, part of what you're just referencing there, this sort of, you know, it's, you know, something that should have lasted 3 days now looks like 6 weeks in. Yeah, this, we could be here for a while.
We could be here for a while. And even if the fighting stops, even if Putin pulls back, the Ukrainians are going to hate the Russians for generations. This is, you know, Zelensky himself pointed this out the other day, where he said, you know, it took the Germans decades and a complete kind of full overhaul of their government and constitutional system before the world, before all of Europe stopped hating the Germans for what mm-hmm. they did in the 40s in World War II. And so, you know, this is going to be a state of permanent hostility until the day Putin is gone from the scene. So, you know, this is, the Americans, I think, have, and the problem for the American people is we are not a patient people.
No,
we don't play
long ball at all.
You know, we want it done and dusted and get, you know, and then on to the next thing. This is going to take a long, even if the fighting stops tomorrow, the diplomatic wreckage and this rebuilding the security architecture of Europe is going to take a long time. And it's going to take a lot of patience and a lot of wisdom and a lot of money. And I think we just have to strap in for that. And Putin, when I said Putin had chosen a forever war, he's basically put Russia in opposition to all of Europe and most of the civilized world pretty much for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And maybe longer, depending on who comes in after.
Yeah, because who comes after him, very much like Biden had to start cleaning up after Trump. This is a lot bigger mess with longer stains from it than what we've seen elsewhere. So you're absolutely right about that. That was
part of the problem with 1991, right? Yeltsin came in and we said, okay, bygones. And that was great because Yeltsin was a good guy, more or less, by the Russian standards. And yet what it really meant is there was a whole Soviet elite behind him that didn't understand. You lost the Cold War and you deserved to lose the Cold War, that there should have been a reckoning. And instead, we have this kind of World War One Germany attitude on the part of the Russians about being stabbed in the back.
Right. Oh, poor us. Exactly.
And, you know, how we weren't given our, you know, we weren't such a bad country after all, and blah, 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 blah. And Putin ran with that. This, how for Russia to come back into the family of nations is going to be a difficult slog for any future Russian leader. And also, you know, I know we got to move on to the other thing, but also this has really, I think, torn the heart out of the United Nations. It really has.
Yeah.
And that's going to take a lot of work to fix, because the United Nations is the only game in town. We're not going to just shut it down and move on.
Yeah, but well, it's, yeah. It's, so, someone should at least have a meeting about that. Because
you notice how much we
get. What possible purpose do they serve? I mean, you got the worst actors on the fucking planet sitting at the table saying, "Yet, no, we're not approving that resolution to condemn the fact that we just killed babies." I mean, what is the point? Is all of this, you know, shrimp cocktail and hand wringing? Who cares?
Cocktail and hand wringing was the first draft of my memoir, by the way. but you're right. I mean, that 6 weeks in, and we don't even say the words. We don't even talk about the Security Council.
They've said nothing.
Yeah, there's nothing that can be done. And this is now going to have to be, the United Nations is a, you know, it's good that it exists, because it's still a place where, in theory, you must come to talk to each other
But they don't, Tom.
I know.
So what's the point? They show up in New York. They come here in the fall. They tie up traffic. They eat.
They don't pay their parking tickets.
They don't pay the damn parking tickets. And they, you know, like I said, they're glad handing and eating shrimp, having cocktails all over town. Then they slither down here to D.C. and do the same thing. I'm like, what's the point? You've got no teeth. You are of no value to solving the problem that's immediately in front of us, because you have in the room the people we all have a problem with.
You know, some expert about 15 years ago wrote a book arguing for a full overhaul of the United Nations.
I wonder who that was.
For just such a moment like this. But, you know, again, people are always more eager to point out when you're wrong than when you're right.
That's why I opened that door. We're going to take a quick break with my buddy and former professor of the National Security Affairs at the U.S. War College. Naval War College. Happy retirement, my friend. Happy retirement.
Thank you very much.
But we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with Tom and talk a little domestic politics right after this.
The Sports Psychology Hour with Dr. Andrew Jacobs is a conversation about success in sports and life, coaching, youth sports, and so much more. Listen to athletes, coaches, parents, and just ordinary folks like you who want to achieve and have fun doing it. Now you can support the show at patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. Get access to ad-free content and exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Just go to patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. That's patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. We are, I told y'all, if you have a conversation with my brother Tom, you're going to sit here and you're going to take out your pad and you're going to write your pen and you're just going to start taking notes, because you brought us.
It will be on the exam.
This will be on the exam, which we have every Tuesday at 2:00. So let's switch it up a little bit, because a lot of what we just talked about globally has played itself out here domestically in terms of how people perceive the president's handling of this matter. Certainly the impact on gas and oil prices here at home, that's fed the flames around inflation and of course on the Republican side, created more fodder to go after Biden. And Lord knows, I find it hysterical when I hear Republicans start talking about how Biden is trying, you know, is trying to take advantage of Ukraine or this or that, just blowing completely past all conversations that Donald Trump had respective to Ukraine. So to set up the sort of domestic part of our conversation, how do you think Americans are absorbing all of it right now for Joe Biden, Republicans, and not just the global piece, but also that domestic piece as we find ourselves some 6 months out from upcoming national midterm elections?
Well, the good news is that there is a wide bipartisan agreement among voters that Ukraine is important, that we're on the right side, that NATO matters, and that the Russians should lose. Unfortunately, that domestic bipartisan agreement does not extend to the elected officials of the Republican Party,
right?
Who are, you know, just trying to make this into, you know, Joe Biden is too senile to handle this. Joe Biden doesn't know what his own policies are. You know, 6 weeks into this war, and they're still trying to pull that, you know, somehow that Biden doesn't know what he's doing. I mean, this is astonishing. The bad news is that Republican voters are so irreversibly partisan that nothing Biden does is going to matter.
Right.
And all that's going to matter in political outcomes is whether Democrats and independent voters come out in enough numbers to save American democracy from a party that has become a pro-Russia authoritarian party. And unfortunately, their attitude is, well, you know, the price of gas went up, so the president sucks.
Right. You just summed it up. That's exactly,
that's incredible.
That's a bumper sticker for them. Yeah.
You know, it is incredible to me. And I have almost, you know, I'm working on a piece about why I'm going to stop arguing, particularly with younger voters for whom, you know, this is their future at stake. And they're like, well, we didn't get the climate change bill. We didn't get better, build back better. We're not getting student loan forgiveness.
Totally
well,
clueless.
Okay, I guess you're going to teach us all a lesson and live under authoritarianism for the rest of your life.
Right.
You know, good luck with that.
Right, right.
But I think it's a reminder of how sort of petty and uncivic the American voter, and I say this about both Democrats and Republicans, the most important thing in the world is happening, and it could end in flames. It could end in disaster. I mean, I don't want to, you know, be overly.
No, you're right. Worrisome, I think you're right.
But there is something going on that could end with the destruction in fire and ashes of tens or hundreds of millions of people. And the reaction among most Americans is, you know, okay, but, you know, gas. Well, there was a time, I get a lot of static when I say things like this, because, you know, it's like, well, you're an elitist, you can afford a gallon of gas, you don't care about this stuff. I'm sorry, I grew up in the 60s and the 70s and came of age in the 80s. There was a time when Americans could differentiate between the price of a gallon of gas and what was important in the world.
Right.
Exactly. You know, they could say, look, I'm, you know, I mean, you and I grew up in a time when inflation
was killing us. It was 20+%.
Here's a lesson in a thing called stagflation. When you had high unemployment, high interest rates, and high inflation all at the same time, which economists didn't think was possible.
Yep.
It was a nightmare. And yet, you didn't see us throw up our hands and say, well, screw it. Democracy's toast. We don't care about what happens in the world. You know, Jimmy Carter, I mean, this is so painful, Michael, because we're, you know, to say nice things about Biden, now I've got to go back and say something nice about Jimmy Carter. You know, Jimmy Carter was able to function in dealing with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan with a public that understood that although Carter was failing in a lot of other areas, this was important.
This
okay.
Was important. That's right.
You know, this was something that we had to deal with and that was worth. And in fact, 1980, an interesting kind of lost art in all this is that one of the things Reagan argued in 80 was, I can handle this crisis better than Jimmy Carter can.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, the actual, in terms of defense budgets and strategies and nuclear stuff, the change from Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan was almost nothing at all.
Right, right.
You know, people like to think it was, but Carter's the guy who starts the MX missile and Trident improvement and the stealth bomber and all that other stuff. And Reagan says, absolutely. And my big disagreement with you is we're not spending enough money on it.
That's it. That's
Americans now are like, well, unless it's good for my team, it sucks. And, you know, they're just not thinking about it.
You wrote what I will term as an indictment of all of that in a piece back in May of 2021 for the Atlantic entitled "The GOP Now Stands for Nothing." And in it, I just want to put two points on the table. The first was you said, quote, "American conservatism once meant something definite and tangible. You could fight those beliefs and policies. You could argue with them, admire them or hate them, but they existed. Strom Thurmond, Ronald Reagan, Howard Baker, and Edward Brooke were not necessarily deep thinkers, and they didn't all agree on everything, but the GOP held clear lines of thought that stood as alternatives to liberalism. That is now gone. We are talking about a party that doesn't even have a platform. It can't tell you what it thinks because it doesn't know what it believes." And so that you have that piece. The second part of this, I thought, was very powerful. You noted, quote, "Most of those ideas were predicated on some basic beliefs about human beings themselves, including the conviction that human nature is fixed rather than malleable, that intellect is a better guide to action than emotion, that tradition is valuable, and that religious faith is a cornerstone of a healthy society." Those two points for me bookend so much of what we see, of what we as you know, I'm still in the GOP. I'm there because I know it pisses them off. So, you know, it's just a good place to be.
I think it's good to tell your listeners, by the way, that you and I have been at this tug of war. I've been trying to pull you out. You've been trying to pull me back
pull
in.
You back in. Pull you out. Dude, I need somebody on the front porch with me to hold up, to keep the lights on. But you really do bookend in a lot of ways, you know, where I came in to the party versus where we are right now. And how do you see this playing out going forward? Because I think someone asked me literally 2 days ago, is it over? Is it done? And I had to hang my head and go, yeah, I don't see recovery.
The party,
the party, being pretty
done,
much
Michael.
Lost.
And here, let me just renew my invitation.
Okay, here we go, folks. Here we go.
We have snacks. I come over. We'll hang out on my deck. The independent voter party is on my back deck here in Rhode Island. Well, a couple of things. First of all, the Republican Party does believe in something, and that is staying in power. If you had to ask, what does Elise Stefanik believe in? Elise Stefanik believes in not going back to upstate New York. That's what she believes in. The Kevin McCarthy, the texts that have been revealed over the past week really show it's a party that whose leaders say, I will say and do anything to stay in Washington. So in that sense, the party is just toast. I want to, because you and I come from the same generation and joined up at about the same time. You know, it frustrates me when younger people say, well, you know, it was always like this. And you guys, when you guys joined in the 70s and the 80s, you were part of the problem. It's like, it's hard to tell younger voters that there was a time when Daniel Patrick Moynihan, one of the most prominent liberal Democratic senators from New York City, said in 1980 that the Republican Party is now the party of ideas.
Yeah, I remember
that. Democratic Party was exhausted and that all of the dynamism and intellectual energy was in the Republican Party. And that's the party in 1980, I was 20 years old. That's the party I was in.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the Republicans have collapsed in on themselves. And, you know, we can sit here and do the autopsy all day long. Is it because, education, rural voters, whatever it is, the party itself now has a layer of electeds on top who are nihilists. And some of them are, I shouldn't say, you know, the Stefaniks and the McCarthys, they're nihilists. They're like, right, I'm not going back home. You can't make me go back home. Right. I like it in DC and I'm not, you know, Josh Hawley, right? You know, right. I wasn't a special little boy so that I could end up hanging out a shingle and probating wills in Sedalia, Missouri. Right. I was destined to live in DC. But I think then you do get the kook factor of Rand Paul. And, you know, that starts to then filter down to the Gohmerts and the Taylor Greens, right, and the rest of them. And so there is no, you know, where is this better party? You know, one of our colleagues, and I'm not saying this to slam him because, you know, I think he's on the side of the Angels. But, you know, years ago, David French and a bunch of us had a kind of an argument about, well, should we still vote for Marsha Blackburn in Tennessee, right? She's going to be one of the good ones, a stable. And David has said, you know, bad idea turned out. But I am hard, other than Kinzinger and Cheney, who are the good ones? Well, who are the ones? Seeds of a new party? They're
I get that all the time. And I shake my head. I go, they've all left or are leaving. And so.
Or the brainworms and the fear. Let me just name check one more person. George Will, who said, and I think this went by without enough kind of wow factor to it. When Will said, this is unprecedented in American history. We have a major party, the Republican Party, that actively fears and hates its own voters.
Yeah.
Now you cannot sustain a political party on a bunch of elites in DC. It's so funny, Michael, that, you know, we get the static about the elites and, you know, we have to, the Republican Party is a party of elites constantly feeding bullshit to a whole, you know, followership of rubes who believe their bullshit.
They are the party not only of elitism, but they're the party of cancel culture. They have their own, snowflakery. They're their own variation of wokeism.
Yep.
You know, the frustration is palpable at this point for a lot of center right, center left Republicans, conservatives, independent voters who once aligned themselves with the party of Reagan, Bush, Eisenhower. So now you're stuck with the likes of J.D. Vance. any thoughts there, my friend?
I wonder if there are any particularly pungent words I would use.
Folks, if you want to get an eyeful, go to Twitter.
Well, or, you know, let me just put it out there. You can go to the piece I wrote in the Atlantic where I called him an asshole.
That does.
And I'm starting to think, you know, that I was being, you know, reputable magazine. We thought about this. We said, geez, is this really, you know, and kind of went back and forth. And I talked about it with some folks and you know, editors and colleagues. And now I'm thinking that we were all being too cautious, because what Vance, what we were just talking about, Michael, where you were talking about elites, Vance is every inch the guy who makes the class transition from a guy like me, a working class, you know,
Some
of these people may not know, but I come from a working class family, you know, factory town, the whole thing. He makes the class transition, as so many of us have. And then he says, you know, what would be cool is if I could use my working class cred to hoodwink a bunch of rubes back home with $10 million of Peter Thiel's money, mm-hmm, in a political action committee and become a senator, where I will pass laws that these people will never know about that will benefit my, you know, my donor class out in Silicon Valley. If Vance were a Democrat, Fox News would have filleted him.
Oh my God.
And laid his entrails in the sun.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just you have to do, take everything about him that we know and just flip that R to a D, and you are exactly right. You are
right.
Exactly
venture right. capital guy from who gets a Yale education, you know, and then comes back home to say, hello, anoint me as your senator, even though I couldn't care less about any of you. Oh, and really interesting misstep, by the way. You would think, being an Ohio boy, Vance wouldn't have pissed on the Ukrainian war.
I know.
It's like somebody then gets to him and says, hey, JD, hey, dude, there's like 70,000 Ukrainians in Ohio, you moron. You might want to walk that one back. If you knew anything about your own state, you wouldn't have said that.
You would not have said that. But he doesn't
know. His state is California and New York and Connecticut. It's not Ohio.
Right. Where do you come down on Elon Musk and free speech? Because here's the thing that pisses me off with the free speech lie. Because I think look, I get being a free speech absolutist, whatever the hell that means. But what I find about platforms like Twitter, the same with Facebook, which I got off about 3 years ago because it was batshit crazy. It made batshit crazy look sane. And I just refused to play. It is hysterical to me in the last 24 to 36 hours to watch the number of followers I've lost because they've left Twitter.
Oh, yeah, it's insane.
But here's my real quickie on this. Do people not understand that the First Amendment doesn't apply here?
That I'm sorry. Could you pitch that softball any slower? No. They do not understand that. Thank you for the, finally an easy question. No, right. They don't understand it. Every time someone's, I defended when there were people bitching about Jack Dorsey and all the other stuff going on Twitter. I said, look, Twitter's a private company. I mean, it's publicly held, but it's not the government. I spent 25 years in the government. I know the difference between the government limiting my speech and, you don't have the right to say anything you want, anywhere you want, without any consequences to your reputation.
That's right.
It's like if you say something asshole-ish and someone says, wow, you sound like an asshole, you can't then say, whoa, 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 free speech. No, free speech. That's my free speech to say you're a jerk.
Right, exactly.
I haven't gotten all wrapped around the axle about this Elon Musk thing because I don't know what he's going to do with Twitter. And like all other consumer products in the world, if I don't like it,
I go somewhere else.
But the people that I lost something to like 23,000 people just like, I have about 614,000 Twitter followers and I think I'm down to like 611 or something.
Right.
Look, this is silly. If you want this to be a good public space for discussion, if you want this bar, I think of Twitter as like a bar. If you want the bar to be a friendly neighborhood bar, then you have to go there.
Bar or is this...
Cheers.
Is this cheers?
Cheers.
Which bar are we going to?
Norm.
I just need to know what I need to put on when I walk in the door.
What's going down? What's going down, Mr. Peterson? My cheeks on that bar stool.
That's it.
So, if you want it to be a hangout where you're talking to people you happen to like, then you have to be there and do it. And if Musk says, I personally think Musk is crazy to do this because I think it's going to be a huge money sink. And I think he's going to end up losing money. Yeah. I think he's just another bored billionaire oligarch who needed a toy to play with. And he's going to get bored with this and other people are going to end up managing it. And I think, if it changes if there are any changes for the better, great. If it changes for the worse, then I'll leave. But preemptively walking out because Elon Musk, stupid. That's like canceling your subscription to the Washington Post because Jeff Bezos bought it.
I did, but I'm just kidding.
I think Musk is a tool. Okay. I mean, I think he's just, I think, he's classic case of a guy that just has more money than sense. He's clearly in some ways a genius. But also, I'm uncomfortable with billionaires whose idea of public service is building rockets and taking rides.
Yeah.
He's done a great thing with SpaceX and he did a great thing with Tesla. That doesn't mean I think he should own the company, but it's a free country.
He can own the
company.
It is. And it really does. But it does make us confront the conundrum, Tom. And that is very much, you've got a very small class of individuals who are controlling more and more of this.
Is our inner liberal coming out, Michael.
I know. And
I agree with you.
And it's not even so much the inner, I guess I'm in that part is in conflict with my my inner libertarian, because, you know, on the one hand, I understand it, but I guess for me, the sense of all of this happening, we're going to wake up one day and, you know, mom and pop aren't going to own it anymore. Mm. And that to me is problematic. But even more problematic is, and I saw a number of questions like this on Twitter, you know, what actually does this man want? I mean, really, at the end of the day, what are his, how much of his politics influence? Because look, he's A, from South Africa, which we can get into that history. B, he is already on record having said some things and backed some things that, you just kind of go, all right, that's not American in that sense. I mean, it's not something that we would necessarily appreciate. So I don't know. I'm like you, reserving judgment. I'll get off the platform if I feel that this, okay, like I did with Facebook, this is just bullshit now, and this is a waste of time, and I'll go somewhere else. You know, I know how to TikTok now. I can.
Okay, but please, please no. no one could see what Michael just did, so we're just going to keep that between us. But I mean, look, I haven't left Facebook yet. I have friends from high school who, for that's their only social media platform.
Yeah, call and me, that, baby. Just there call are people. Me. I don't need to talk to you on that grid. Just call
I
me.
Know, but you know, and I thought about it, and then I'm like, okay, but there are people there that you know that is the only way of staying in touch with them. And I think Mark Zuckerberg is, you know, the walking poster boy for the banality of evil. You know, as far as you asked, what does he want? I think he's an overgrown man child who is bored.
Yeah.
And he does things. Sometimes it works out great. He's bored. He creates SpaceX. That's great. But there is I think with all of our kind of gazillionaire class, there's just this fundamental unseriousness about them that I think reflects the unseriousness of the time we live in. You know, at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries, people like Andrew Carnegie, they understood, yeah, we're incredibly rich, but we'd better start acting like some kind of a public institution. Yeah. Like I better start building libraries and endowing universities, because otherwise they really are going to start dragging the robber barons out into the public square here.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And
right.
I think, I said this to my wife the other day. I was taking something back through Amazon Prime, and I said, I love Amazon Prime. I think it's cool. On the other hand, I don't think it's cool that this guy is about to become a trillionaire.
Yeah.
You know, that at some point he becomes a trillionaire. And I think in a just society, we can balance, I joke about our inner liberal, but I think we can balance our sense of individual freedom, that you have the right to go as far. Like when people used to bitch about how much money Bill Gates has, I'd say Bill Gates has probably never been adequately compensated for the worth of the thing he put out there in creating an operating system.
Right.
Like with all the money he has, a just world would probably pay him even more. But I think at some point you say, for the sake of the social compact, for the sake of a fundamental sense of justice, that super ultra gazillionaires have to, let me interrupt myself and say, you know how the ancient Greeks did this? They built the Parthenon. At some point, the treasury got so full of money that was getting concentrated in the city. They said, okay, we need to hire a bunch of artisans and, you know, sculptors and architects, and we need to put this money back into circulation. Right. So we'll build a Parthenon. Well, maybe we ought to build a Parthenon. Maybe we ought to call it a cure for cancer or the Mars mission or whatever it is. We need to get that money back into society. When I was younger, I'm sure you were the same way as a kind of college Republican. My answer was the Robert Nozick libertarian answer, which is, if a billion people each give you a dollar, there is no right by which the government takes back some of those dollars.
Right.
And the fact that you're a billionaire, if you know, justly acquired assets and so on. On the other hand, I feel like I'm almost going to kind of go down the Elizabeth Warren route here and say there is some obligation to the society that made that possible. The institutions and the laws and the infrastructure that made that possible. Now, I think she goes too far when she says, you didn't build that. Well, because
you did.
If everybody could build it, everybody would. You know, if it were easy, everyone would do it. Right. So I think we have to find something in between. you know, Elon Musk and Elizabeth Warren and say that we have to have, I mean, you know, Republicans are not, I shouldn't say this. Republicans didn't used to be against all taxes, all government, all forms of, collective action. They wanted justification for taxes. They wanted effective government. They wanted consensual and well-organized and well-executed community efforts rather than, you know, kind of big blobby bureaucracies doing things. And I think that's the Republican Party that I once thought existed. And I think that's now where the kind of center, centrist, center left of the Democratic Party is. When I'm happy to work with those folks, but I fear that the Democratic left and the progressive left is going to, coming back to your question, because we were talking about the future of democracy here. If the Democrats lose in 22 and then again in 24, all of these piddling arguments about policy are going to seem quaint.
Oh my gosh, yes. Folks don't know what's in store for them. They
These people are as serious as a fucking heart attack.
They have no appreciation. They have no appreciation.
And the people that are bitching about infrastructure and student loans and all that other stuff, man, that in we're going to be sitting around in 2025 saying, hey, remember those cool days? Remember those placid spring afternoons where we were all sitting around bitching about interest rates and gas prices and student loans? That's going to seem like the good old days compared to what will come.
Because we'll all be sitting in front of a television watching a neighbor, friend, or someone we know standing before a Republican congressional senatorial committee being hauled across the coals, and President Trump in the beginning of his second term, you know, wreaking revenge, and that's it. And
imagine if Joe McCarthy hadn't been stopped.
That's it.
That's where we're going. And the courts will, you know, continue to be packed with judges that will nod politely. My friend David Frum warned about this. He said that everybody's watching the elections. Watch the courts. Because the thugocracy is, the goal is to pack. It's to replace bureaucrats and judges that are friendly to this kind of, you know, right-wing authoritarian, I don't want to call it fascist, because fascists actually believe in something, but this kind of nihilist, you know, kind of social revanchist politics that we're about to live through.
You want to get, you know, for the party that always bitched about liberal judges and their activism on the court, I give you the judge who just decided not to apply only to the plaintiff in the case, but to the entire nation, that we all take your mask off now.
I have taken so much shit about this, Michael, because I've said, look, the mask mandate was outdated and it needed to
follow that story
this way.
Yes,
it was a bad, and I said people were totally, again, the inability to hold any kind of nuanced view that isn't perfectly tribal. I said, it's good that the masks are gone. Now Biden should go to court and challenge this.
Right.
Because he needs to preserve the executive's power to do this against this overreaching judge. But, you know, I just wanted to kind of reach through the screen and give you a man hug on this issue of judges, because I was banging the table about this even before Trump. I said, wait a minute, weren't we the people, weren't we conservatives the ones who were saying, if you can't get what you want at the ballot box, you don't have any right to get it through judges?
That's right.
If most Americans are still pro-choice, you know, for example, to open that can of worms, if most Americans want abortion in some form to be legal, by what right do you then say, well, I'll just stack judges? The same thing they argued after Roe v. Wade. You're just putting pro-abortion judges,
right?
You know,
I'm going to put pro-life judges on.
I was going to say, you said that was bad on principle, and now you're doing it. And again, it's the new Republicanism is, it's okay if we do it.
It's okay if we do. That sums it up right there. It's okay if we do it. And if we don't get to do it, neither will you.
If we don't get to do it, well, neither will you, because we'll just burn everything down.
We'll burn everything down. Tom Nichols, my man. Thank you so much, brother, for bringing it as I knew you would. I always enjoy our conversations, and it's a real pleasure having you here in the house this afternoon and sort of laying down some tracks for us overseas and here at home.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to spend time with you as always.
I appreciate it, brother. Well, that does it for our conversation at this time, folks. You know, I love it when you do that download thing and really help us out when you go out there and check out the Spreaker app and Apple Podcasts and Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts on. And don't forget that if you like the episode to check it out on the Spreaker app and make some comments. It just helps me improve my game for you. I'd love to do that. And follow Tom, please, on Twitter. You got, well, in whatever form it
unless
is.
Unless you're trying to keep your blood pressure down.
Right. You can follow Tom on Twitter at Radio Free Tom. Certainly check me out at Michael Steele. Until next time, be blessed, be well, and happy Orthodox Easter to you, my friend. And
thank you very much, Michael.
To all of you, take care.
Right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.